maybe three points. One, a little bit on my personal political evolution and thinking about these questions, and then I want to say some things on why I think seasteading is not just possible or desirable, but why it is actually necessary, both from a political and technological perspective. And I want to touch on that a little bit in my comments. I think my personal political evolution in some ways is rather similar to Patry's. I was, when I was a teenager, when I was an undergraduate at Stanford, very much believed in the importance of the give and take of political debate, and thought that what you had to do was convince people of your ideas. And so I started one of these independent student newspapers, and but most of it really was the metaphor I have is not like the pulling on a rope. It was more like trench warfare in World War I on the Western Front, where you had incredible amounts of carnage, and everybody said, we need to charge, and people need to ignore the machine guns and work around the clock, licking envelopes and ringing doorbells, or whatever like slightly more elevated versions of that are. And there was really no progress was ever made. And you had some sort of very marginal victories, but it just doesn't seem like it's worth the amount of effort that got expended. And in my 20s when I was living in New York, you sort of start to understand why people get very pessimistic about stuff. And there's sort of a version of where I thought you could almost measure someone's IQ by their degree of pessimism. And so that, the really optimistic people were generally not very bright. And then there were people who were a little bit smarter. They were like maybe secretly pessimistic, but they thought it was moral that people should be exhorted to lick envelopes and ring doorbells. And then there were really smart people who just got extremely pessimistic and thought that there's nothing an individual can really do in the face of the relentless indifference of the universe. And so you basically, if you're sort of, and so it sort of often sort of manifested itself on the part of people who were more conservative and, excessive amounts of alcohol consumption. And of course, the people who were libertarian didn't necessarily limit themselves to alcohol. But in any event, I think my optimistic cut on this, and sort of where I started to shift my views on this a little bit, was that I started to think that maybe one didn't have to be so pessimistic if things were not limited to politics, and if there were things other than politics, maybe there were actually things one could do. And I think the venue that I think is an incredibly important venue for change is technology, because it is something that a small number of individuals or people can do. They can build companies, and those companies can change the world in ways that can sometimes happen so quickly or in such unexpected ways that the political system cannot fully grasp it. And by the time the change has happened, maybe there'll be some reaction, and maybe you'll get the aircraft carrier coming towards the seastead. But if you have 10,000 different seasteads, maybe it'll be too late. And I think that's I think there is an element of technology where it is a way for people to unilaterally bring about change and make the world a better place. I think there was, certainly a very big narrative of the internet of the late 90s and throughout this decade where it has been about that. I think the jury on it is still out. How big a deal it's going to be. Is it world transforming? Is it just this virtual reality that's too tangential? I think it's definitely worth the effort. I think all these things are. But I think seasteading in particular is a very interesting version, because it's sort of at the point where it involves real live human beings. It's unlike the internet, it's in a real place. And unlike outer space, I think it is much closer on the technology side, even though we can debate whether it's still utopian or not. And this is, I think, a very important question for people to explore today. And so this was sort of the basic frame that got me towards looking at technological solutions as a way to move the world in a direction that will make it more free. Now, I want to just say two sort of quick thoughts, and these will echo many of the ideas different people have, on why I think it is both politically and technologically necessary for us to be doing something like seasteading in on this planet in the next in the decades ahead. And the political one, which I think many people have focused, and I'll just say something very briefly on it. It goes to the question of freedom and regulatory arbitrage. And the way I like to frame that particular question is as the thought experiment. And the thought experiment is that in the year 1945, you had about 45 countries in the world. Today we have probably about 200 countries, maybe a little bit more. I think 192 in the United Nations, in practice a little bit more than that. And the thought experiment question to ask is, fast forward to the year 2050, how many countries will exist in the world? Is the number going to be greater than 200, less than 200, or exactly 200? And the three answers to that question give you three different futures of the world, and we can sort of map out what they will be like. And there are a lot of details about them that that are different. But I would say one variable that I think is incredibly important is if we have a future of the world in which there are, let's say, 1,000 countries versus 200, which would be sort of a weirdly, people would sort of be suggesting that nothing would change. I think the middle case is actually very unlikely. Or if we go reverse it and we have, let's say, 20 countries or two countries or one country, what are some of the attributes of this? And one that I would submit strikes me as very obvious is that the marginal tax rates will vary quite a bit depending on the number of countries. And so if you looked at the world, the United States, 1950s, marginal tax rates were 91%. And if you didn't like that, you could move to the Soviet Union, you could move to various other places where the rates were even higher. And today they have, they have relentlessly come down. And I know that a lot of people are very worried about taxes going up imminently in the near future. I actually am fairly optimistic about this. I think this is not going to happen because there are too many countries. And I think we have a microcosm of this test going on in the state of California right now, where the government's run out of money and the normal thing is to raise taxes, and you have all these people who are threatening to leave the state of California. And so far, in spite of the worst financial crisis since the 30s, they've not been able to raise marginal tax rates in California. They're not able to do it in New York. I predict they will not be able to do it in the United States as a whole. And so we're going to be headed towards quite a systemic crisis, even though I think it's in a way a fairly positive thing, because as long as globalization continues and people can exit and you have different countries, and the numbers going up, you'll have this incredible pressure. And again, the different version of the thought experiment would be if the city of San Francisco were an independent country. So it's like would be one of the most left-wing socialist countries in the world. And I would predict the tax rates in San Francisco would be like Hong Kong. The marginal rate would be maybe 15%, 16%. If you could just move to Marin or to South San Francisco, it would be taxes way lower than the most right-wing part of the United States, the most libertarian part of the United States. You would have super low taxes. And it has nothing to do with the ideology, the people, or anything like that. It is just the structure. And I think the structure gets driven in large part by the technology. And this is why I think anything that can be done to create much larger numbers of countries will be very good. And so I will just leave it as this thought experiment for 2050 and what will be the number of countries in the world at that point. And I think that if we want to increase freedom, we want to increase the number of countries. Now, the other third thread I want to say just a few words about is the sort of technological question. And I want to actually take a very different cut at this sort of a question, where normally the question about the feasibility goes to all these questions: is it possible, is it not possible? There's sort of questions about it's possible, but it's not desirable. Would anybody really want to live on a seastead or that? Really frame the technological question more as a question of almost necessity, of whether something like this is necessary. And if you sort of think of a 2x2 standard matrix of whether it's possible or desirable, most of the people here are somewhere on the possible and desirable quadrant, maybe with some reservations, but we obviously think it's at least somewhat possible and that it would be somewhat desirable. There are, if we think about the people outside this room, there are probably quite a lot of people who think that it's not possible, but that's a good thing. And so it's sort of weird. People shouldn't be living on oceans, and those are actually we don't need to really worry about those people very much, because since they don't think it's possible, they won't take us very seriously, and they will not actually try to stop us till it's too late. There's an even smaller number of people who think that possible but not desirable. So the people who think it's not possible and not desirable. So it's not possible, and it's good. Sorry, let me frame it this way: good and bad, possible, impossible. So the people who think that it is, we think that it's possible and good. The people who think that it is not possible and that that's a good thing, that it's not possible, we don't need to worry about. The people who think that it is possible and would be bad, we do need to worry about, because they will try to actually stop us. But fortunately, that's an even smaller group than the second group. The group that I think is actually really big, and that we never think about, is the group that basically thinks that seasteading is not possible, and it doesn't really matter one way or the other. And I want to sort of suggest that that's the group that's the most wrong, because if you sort of imagine a world where nothing is going to happen, and this is sort of what is considered good, this tells you that there are some very weird things off with the technological sort of vision of the future. And basically, I think taking sort of a step back from seasteading, one of the critical questions we have to ask is whether we're in this sort of exponentially growing technological civilization, or whether we're in a place where there's stasis and nothing is happening, just to sort of go to Patry's point, not so much on the political, social level, but the technological level. And if you have, you know, an exponentially accelerating civilization, you expect there to be sort of a lot of, you know, major breakthroughs. And it's sort of like, you know, I think this is sort of like the image of science fiction books from the 1950s and 1960s. We'd have colonies on the moon, you'd have robots, you'd have flying cars, you'd have cities in the ocean, under the ocean. You'd have eco-farming. You'd turn the deserts into arable land. There were sort of all these incredible things that people thought would happen in the 50s and 60s, and that would sort of transform the world. And you know, if we're honest, some of these things have happened and some have not. And there are, I think, some legitimate concerns about whether technology has progressed quite as quickly as we would have liked. There's a book that was written in 1968 by a left-of-center French writer, which we can perhaps dismiss too easily, Zerbon Schreiber, The American Challenge, described what an exponentially accelerating civilization in the United States would look like. And it basically said that if you had exponentially accelerating technology, by the year 2000, the U.S. would be so far ahead of the rest of the world, people would no longer need to compete with anybody else. And so the average person would, in the U.S., in the year 2000, would work 7 hours a day, 4 days a week, have 13 weeks a year of paid vacation, because the technology would move so quickly you would no longer need to compete. Now, this, you know, has not entirely happened. And I think we need to ask some, you know, very hard questions why the future has not arrived as quickly as people hoped it was going to arrive in the late 1960s. And we know the future history of Star Trek, 1967, we'd have lunar bases by 1980, manned missions to Mars by 1990, and it would go on from there to the stars. And I think I think most people are actually extremely complacent about this set of questions. As I said, they don't worry about it, they don't think it matters. But the problem is they have all these other things that they're doing that are implicitly dependent on accelerating technology. And I'll give you just one sort of financial example of this, which is that basically, if we were to go outside this hotel and take a survey of people, and they'd say, you know, 90% of them, I would guess, even though I'm not taking the survey, I'm just making these numbers up, would say, yeah, seasteading's crazy, it's not going to happen, and it doesn't matter, it's probably a good thing it's not going to happen. So they're sort of in this very big quadrant. But they also think that their house prices are going to go up 8 to 10% a year, that if they put money into the stock market, it's going to grow 8 to 10% a year. They believe that that they have money in pension funds that's automatically going to grow. And you have to sort of ask, how is all of this actually possible when there is when they're envisioning no technological progress whatsoever. I was speaking at a university trustees group in North Carolina that invested in my venture fund about a week ago, and you know, they had about 5% of their money was allocated to venture capital, the other 95% to other stuff. Venture capital piece hasn't been really working for the last 10 years, and so they're wondering whether they should dial back that 5%. And I was explaining to them, well, you know, if that 5% doesn't work, if technology is not going to actually make any progress, you know, you're not going to make any money on the other 95%. So, if you want a sort of a Pascal's wager type argument, you can say that you might as well put all your money into venture capital, because if that doesn't work, you know, everything else is going to be worthless anyway. And this was just a shocking thing to them, because they didn't think these two things are connected at all. And they don't think that exponential technological progress is somehow secretly embedded in all the financial models. And if you ask, you know, why do people think the stock market goes up 10% a year? Well, it's because it's done that for the last 100 years on average. And why has it done it for the last 100 years? It's because we've had extraordinary technological progress for the last 100 years. If you were in a completely static world, let's say you were living in the late declining stages of the Roman Empire from 400 AD to 500 AD, I suspect that if you had invested in the equivalent of the stock market, you would not have gotten 10% a year returns. You probably would have been done extraordinarily well to sort of get something like zero. And so there are these, and it seems to me that that one of the sort of challenges we have is that on the one hand, this sort of stuff is perceived as incredibly strange and incredibly weird, and yet it is implicitly assumed by everybody who bought a large house in Las Vegas, everybody who's putting money into an equity index fund. And one of our challenges is try to sort of connect the dots and make it clear to people that these things are very, very deeply linked together. I think one of the challenges that we have in terms of, to the extent we are talking to people outside this group and not just acting unilaterally, I think one of the things that needs to be very much retold is the narrative of what happened in 2008 and the sort of economic crash that took place. And it is typically described as a credit crisis. And what credit is involves claims on the future. And it's so like, Patry, I'm going to lend him some money. He's going to pay me back more in the future because I assume there's going to be all this progress and growth, and that's why he will be able to pay me more. And in some sense, I can think, people focus on it being too much regulation, too little regulation, people are stupid or greedy, all these sort of psychological explanations. I think the way you need to think of this entire economic crisis is as a technological crisis, where people basically assumed there was going to be very rapid progress, and it didn't quite happen. And that's why all the money they owed, which implicitly assumed this exponential progress, all of a sudden couldn't get paid off, and you have a crisis. And it's very important for us to diagnose the crisis correctly if we're going to solve it. If we misdiagnose, we will never solve it. And so one of the things I think we need to sort of try to do is somehow go back to the future, back to the way people thought the future was going to progress in the 1950s, 1960s, a world of runaway exponential progress. And that is sort of the way we need to get out of it. And so the question of whether seasteading is desirable or possible, in my mind, is not even relevant. It is absolutely necessary. And so I'll let other people figure out how to do it. But from my point of view, it is simply unnecessary that it be done. And I think that the alternative is for all of us to sort of gently go into that good night, which I refuse to do. Thank you very much. All right. Yes, go ahead.
So why do you think we haven't made the kind of progress in the physical sciences, I guess, technological advances that people were imagining in the 50s and 60s, but we have made rapid advances in the information sciences? Now, I remember, it struck me, the movie 2001, and all the all the spacecraft and stuff wasn't there when 2001 arrived, but all the technology was not only there, but more advanced than what was in the movie. And one thing you can say is the government was responsible for the space program and the private sector is responsible for the information science. But is there something else? Is it just harder to do this, build spacecraft?
I don't have I have all sorts of speculative theories on the why question. I would say on the what question, and I don't think there has been progress in the last 40 years. Obviously, there's been tremendous progress in the information revolution, the internet, some progress in biotechnology. I think a little bit less there than I would have liked. There's been but other areas there has been somewhat less. And I think there are sort of many different sort of why-type explanations I can give. The cultural one I sort of bias towards is that there's a degree to which people don't think this stuff matters, and that they don't study it, they don't devote their lives to it, they don't focus on it. They think that it's a problem that other people will solve, and that basically we can just figure out the way to get the house in Vegas, and that's what we should specialize in, and other people will figure out a way to have this runaway exponential progress. And, this sort of that sort of a free rider approach generally works, but it doesn't work when, everybody believes it. And I think something like that has happened. I think there obviously are all sorts of crazy government incentives. There's an argument that every this is slightly polemical, but there's an argument that every ailment and disease in the United States is the fault of the government, and that basically, it's that's why we have people who are fat, that's why we have people, who have all sorts of health issues of one sort or another, and so I think there's probably a very big, very big governmental part of this. I would say though, setting aside the why question. And even setting aside the what question, from today going forward, we have to make progress on these sorts of things. So we can debate whether there was a lot of progress in the last 40 years or not. We can debate whether, why there may have been slower progress. What I'm interested in is just getting it restarted today, and because I think the place where the really big gains will be made in the next 20 years are in some of these sort of more foundational material sciences, some of these hard technologies that need to get built out and to really generate the kinds of things where you can have an economy that's massively growing. Yes. Well, it happened very quickly. And so people were not able to get on top of regulating it. So I think that may be a why component. Certainly, my experience at PayPal, where we, created this new financial service, which attracted a great deal of regulatory scrutiny. It happened sort of so quickly that the regulators were too slow to respond. So we went public in February 2002. There were some people in the state of Louisiana who wanted to shut us down because maybe we're doing illegal banking. You called up the bank regulators in Louisiana and said, there are 100,000 people with PayPal accounts in the state of Louisiana, 3,000 small businesses. Does Louisiana really want to get a reputation as a state that's technologically backwards and hostile to progress? And the answer was, no, we don't, and so we'll let it keep going. And so I think the fact that you have, like a large, I think there is a velocity of it that is actually fairly critical, and so I don't know when we start building seasteads en masse, but it probably would be helpful if once we started building them, we started building hundreds a year.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yes, go ahead. Well, I think the ones that I'm most excited about are all you know, we have a venture capital fund. I basically try to redirect all of it towards, you know, science fiction type investing. So it's basically space, robots, AI, you know, next wave biotech. We're going to try to fund a seasteading related venture if we can figure out the right way to do it. So that's one of the things is, you know, we try to incubate a for-profit company to do something on a seasteading context. But I think as an investor, I like those areas the best because they seem to be so extraordinarily out of fashion among everybody else. So if you know, even if we just find one seasteading company and one space company and one robotics company, they'll do very well because nobody else is investing in the stuff. Yes. I don't, you know, I think it's, don't have a strong view on nanotech. It is, you know, a lot of these technologies have happened slower than people were predicting. If you sort of think of Drexler's Engines of Creation book, which I think was written in 1986 or something like that, you know, it certainly has taken, you know, it's taken a bit longer. I would, you know, I'd sort of focus on the science fiction technologies of the 50s and 60s at this point, so space, robots, some of the biotech stuff, you know, so some of the AI type stuff, and so you know, but nanotech may be there, may not be. Don't have a strong view on it. Yes. Well, I think one of the sort of very difficult problems for the United States as a country is that we have this very troubled history where you had the attempt to break it up in the 1860s was motivated by something that was objectively pretty evil, namely slavery. And so because of that, whenever people talk about secession of states and a breakup of the United States into various pieces, you automatically end up sounding like you're racist and have something, and you want to do something really, really crazy. And so I think there is sort of a weird part of the U.S. history that makes it unusually difficult to break the U.S. into different components. Now, you know, that being said, I do think objectively the U.S. should be many different countries, and you could say the only thing that sort of currently makes the U.S. a single big country is sort of the global military might that it is able to project, and basically, and if you didn't think that was an important value, we should just have all these countries be different because people's values in Texas are radically different from San Francisco, and it seems very bad to have just one group trying to sort of domineer the other and sort of alternate at various points. And so rationally, it should be many different countries. Very hard to do given the cultural history of this country. Yeah, go ahead. I will not be able to attend your untalk because I unfortunately have like a crazy schedule that gets scheduled by people, and I sort of have not been able to assert enough control over my life in general. And I do not discount my life sufficiently 6 months into the future, and I'm willing to commit to things like speaking at this event and things of that sort. And so I unfortunately will not be able to do it. However, I think the biotech areas that I think are the most promising are the intersection of biotech with various other technologies. And I think we may be close to a point where it is possible for people to start biotech companies who do not have PhDs or MBAs. And so the basic criterion that we have for investing in biotech is companies in which the people do not have PhDs or MBAs. because they all have screwed up massively. For 30 years, they've run an industry where people have, on the whole, returned no money to investors. And it's been marginal academic projects, and then typically they're dressed up by MBA people who are salesy and markety and substance-free. And in sort of a bad way, and so I think there is at this point enough information out there that people can learn on the internet that you can have people start very successful companies who don't necessarily have all the right credentials, and that's what I think is very hopeful. So I think there's sort of at our LP meeting on my venture fund in a month, we're going to have like a discussion on sort of what we're describing as garage biotech and how people can actually start biotech companies out of a garage at this point. And that's sort of the direction I think is worth looking into.